From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Philip Morris tops the list of contributors in the 1996 elections.
It's not just a story of how much money we spend on elections. It's a story about regular people denied a fair shot at running for office because they can't raise this kind of money. A story of the favors that special interests receive for campaign contribution, and a story of lawmakers who spend more time chasing money than they do doing their jobs.
And we'll look back at the Young Lords, the militant Puerto Rican civil rights group that rose up in the barrios of this country.
On the whole, we were first-generation Puerto Ricans born and or raised in this country. And we found as we started going out into the world that the society was a very white society.
And the conditions in the community at that time were dire. There were a lot of drugs. The housing was abominable. The health care was non-existent.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Bill Clinton began airing a new ad defending his integrity. The ad features former White House Press Secretary James Brady, who was partially paralyzed in the attempt on President Reagan's life. Brady says Clinton showed the character in fighting for the handgun waiting period law that bears his name. And House Speaker Newt Gingrich wants congressional hearings into contributions to President Clinton's campaign by an Indonesian banking family. He also wants the president to hold back selling F-16 fighter planes to Indonesia until Congress holds the hearings. And Bob Dole has been hammering away at the contributions, saying they amount to laundered money that should be sent back by Clinton. In today's Washington Post, it says Republicans yesterday escalated their rhetoric over what they called illegal foreign contributions to the Democratic National Committee, while the DNC said it would investigate new allegations that at least one contributor at a Buddhist temple fundraiser was given $5,000 cash and small bills and asked to write a check to the party. And this international news, 4 months after publicly embracing him as a political heir, President Boris Yeltsin angrily appeared on national television last night and dismissed Alexander Lebed, his frank and aggressive national security chief. Looking frail but determined in his first prolonged television appearance in weeks, Yeltsin said he could no longer tolerate the brazen and subordinate behavior of the 46-year-old former Army general. And here in this country, a team of researchers says it has found a direct scientific link between smoking and lung cancer, a discovery that adds yet another piece to the already substantial evidence that tobacco smoking is a cause of cancer. The findings published today in the Journal of Science report the first evidence from the cell biology level linking smoking to lung cancer. The scientists say a chemical found in cigarette smoke has been found to cause genetic damage in lung cells that is identical to the damage observed in many malignant tumors of the lung. The findings reported establish the long-missing link in the opinion of experts in the field of cancer genetics and may also play a role in pending litigation about smoking illnesses and passive smoking. And you're listening to Democracy Now! And now we're going to talk about campaign contributions. Yesterday, here in Washington, D.C., a news conference was held by the Center for Responsive Politics. It issued its big report on campaign contributions in the 1996 election cycle. The Center, one of the leading groups that tracks the corrupting influence of money and politics in our democracy, has found that cigarette maker Philip Morris is the number one campaign stocking stuffer. Other top donors include AT&T, trial unions, RJR Nabisco, and financial companies like securities and real estate firms. Big business outspent labor 7-1. We now bring you an excerpt from yesterday's press conference where the staff of the Center for Responsive Politics released its report.
I'm Ellen Miller, Executive Director of the Center for Responsive Politics. Today, the Center for Responsive Politics is reporting to the American people on who is paying for this election, and to the degree we can figure it out, how much is actually being spent. But before we get into the details, which my colleagues from the center will present to you, I want to tell you that this election cycle, which is, I think, at least my fourth presidential election cycle following the issue of money in politics, is different in a number of respects, significantly different. First, our conservative estimate is that the presidential election campaign will cost $800 million when all is said and done. This is nearly a threefold increase over the previous presidential election cycle. The figure for congressional campaigns will likely be the same, that is another $800 million, meaning that we will spend $1.6 billion on federal election campaigns this year. Second, our analysis shows that this money is not coming from ordinary Americans. In 1994, for example, we know that less than 0.25% of the American people made a campaign contribution of $200 or more to a candidate, and this election cycle will be no different. American elections are paid for overwhelmingly by economically interested industries and by a small handful of individuals. We have a political system paid for literally by Wall Street, not Main Street, or perhaps we could also say it's being paid for by Tobacco Road. Next, our analyses show us that those who give get something in return. The ability of campaign contributors to cash in on their investments was pretty surprising when we looked back over this election cycle. As the money rolled in, the favors were doled out. Today, we'll explore just what the largest business, labor, and ideological interests wanted in the last Congress and what they got. You know, we had to laugh last Sunday when House Speaker Newt Gingrich accused the Clinton administration of offering special deals for big campaign contributors. If contributions from private interests are a problem for the Democrats, which they certainly are, then they are also a problem for Republicans. It's time we came down hard on the political double standard. In reality, our campaign finance system is a quid pro quo system. Both parties and every candidate is up to his or her eyebrows in it. Should we look at the relationship between Golden Rule Financial Corporation and the Speaker's unabashed promotion of medical savings accounts? What about Bob Dole's financial support from Archer Daniels Midland and his promotion of ethanol subsidies? Does the Republican Party go to bat for tobacco interest? Was Nations Bank $3.5 million loan to the DNC in 1994 a quid pro quo for the administration's support of interstate banking legislation? Let's be really clear. When candidates for political office solicit and receive big bucks for their political campaigns, big favors are incurred. Both parties know it, and both parties do it. Fourth, what we know is that the presidential and congressional campaign finance systems in this election cycle particularly have become like the emperor who has no clothes. No one really wants to talk about it, but soft money, issue campaigns, so-called independent expenditures by political parties, all these kinds of spending mean that we have de facto a deregulated campaign finance system, and much of this money is not even reported. Today, you'll have a chance to hear from a number of senior center staffers who will tell you what we do know and hopefully give you some indication of what we don't know as well. Larry Makinson, who is our deputy director, will give you an overview of who's paying for this election, and we'll go through a series of charts and graphs with you. Jennifer Keene, our Open Secrets Research Associate, will walk you through the soft money contributions, clearly the biggest funnel for big money in the political year. And Nancy Watzman, who is director of our Cashing In Project, will go through the highlights of some of the relationships between the money in and the decisions out of this last Congress. We have also detailed contribution profiles for every race in the country. Those will be found at the table in the front, just outside the room, but also you'll find them on our website, the address for which is www.crp.org, contribution profiles for every race in the country. In addition to these materials, what I most hope you leave here with is a desire to look more deeply into the story of private money in our politics. It's not just a story of how much money we spend on elections. It's a story about regular people denied a fair shot at running for office because they can't raise this kind of money. a story of the favors that special interests receive for campaign contribution, and a story of lawmakers who spend more time chasing money than they do doing their jobs. Larry?
I want to run through a few things on the big picture section of where the money is coming from here, and start off from a very general area. Let me tell you, first of all, what did we look at when we did compile all this data? Our starting point was the Federal Election Commission download, that they're now putting this stuff every month on the web, of PAC contributions, soft money contributions to the political parties, and contributions to the presidential candidates, Clinton and Dole, both PAC contributions and individual contributions. We also took a look at individual contributions to candidates. That's a much tougher nut to crack. We were going to try to do something on that. In fact, we did look at it, but we were only able to identify at this stage about 37% of the source of that money. So we did not include it in this report. However, we have some sense of where the patterns are in there, and they seem to be pretty similar to what they were last year and what they have been in the past pretty consistently. We did find a number of surprises, though, and I want to share some of those with you and share sort of the big picture of what's going on. First of all, looking at it demographically, we did take the individual contributions and tried to break them down by state. And we see the two big bars. You probably can't see the names of the states, but there's probably not too many people in the room that couldn't guess that they're California and New York. Texas comes in third, then Florida, New Jersey, Illinois, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania. It's roughly population-based, but California and New York are really way up there. Also, the District of Columbia is respectable in there. This does include only individual contributions. If you include all contributions from the areas, then the D.C. area actually is much higher because the parties are here, the PACs are here, there's a whole bunch of money. Basically, half the PAC money in the country comes from the Washington metro area. I might also mention to you that these figures are really midterm. Even though we downloaded them from the FEC on the 1st of October, they really only cover the period safely through the end of June into July, some of it in August. Depends on when people filed their reports. So we're really seeing a snapshot that's a couple of months behind in time. And that's very important, particularly when I look at places like Los Angeles, and we know there have been a lot of very big dollar fundraisers in LA. They have been in other places as well. So that money we're really not going to know about until after the election is all over, unfortunately. The next thing I want to get into is a little bit about the patterns we found to the overall industries. When you combine the money of the PAC money plus the soft money plus the money to the presidential candidates, and also let me give you some sense here of how much we actually were able to identify. On the contributions to Clinton and Dole, which came in for the primary election campaign, since they're not allowed to directly take money during the general, we identified about 70% of that money. We were able to identify the, look at the company that people put down, who they worked for, identify its economic interest, or the same for ideological groups. On the soft money, we were able to identify about 74% of the money. And in PACs, we were able to identify 99.9% of the money. We basically know who the PACs are pretty well. So just to give you some sense of what we're looking at, and again, what we're not looking at. On the overall patterns, when you combine all those sources of money, basically the big bar you see in the middle is the financial sector. This is finance, insurance, real estate. Primarily, the biggest sources in there are the securities firms, Wall Street, commercial banks, insurance companies. Those are the really big ones. Let's see, securities, banks, insurance, and real estate also. Those are the four big ones in there. Labor stands out a bit over here. Actually, the total number, by the way, in case you can't read the dollars in there, for the financial sector was about $59 million if you add together the Democrats and the Republicans. So it's quite a bit of money. It has been traditionally the leading source of money to federal campaigns, both particularly at the congressional level. In the presidential level, lawyers are very big. And the other thing I'd like to mention, that because we didn't do individual contributions, the you can safely assume that when those contributions are added in, the lawyer lobby group will rise considerably, since about 75% of the money from lawyers and lobbyists comes through individual contributions. Now, it certainly was fairly well represented in soft money and in PACs, particularly from the Trial Lawyers Association, but there's a lot more to come. Actually, all these charts are going to grow pretty healthily between now and the election, the time we find the final sources of all this money. But our expectation is that more or less they're going to be in the same proportion. If you added together the business side of this chart, which really is most of it, basically everything from agriculture through to transportation and then a section called miscellaneous business, and compared that with what labor gave versus what ideological groups would gave, and you'll find a chart showing this in your packets, there's basically about $288 million from business, $126 million of which went to Democrats, $160 million of which went to Republicans, $242 million from business, $35 million from labor, and about $10 million from ideological groups. So basically, if you add this part of the graph together and compare it with labor, it's a 7-to-1 business more than labor. So labor, there's been a lot of talk of spending a lot of money in independent campaigns. No doubt there's a lot being done by business, but there's no comparison when you compare the overall economic impact of business contributions versus labor. When we looked at trying to figure out who were the top overall contributors, the name that came to the list is a familiar one to anyone that's been watching politics, Philip Morris, the big tobacco company. They gave $2.7 million, and what we did on the overall big contributors, because we do know a lot of them do make individual contributions of their executives to individual candidates, we also checked the individual databases, individual contributions for them. So Philip Morris, $2.7 million. Number two is AT&T, which they've been sort of the top of the pack and business packs in the past, but they hadn't been that high. That was actually somewhat of a surprise to see AT&T that high. That was certainly connected with the telecommunications package, and you'll hear more about AT&T when Nancy talks about what they got and what they gave and what they got back in return. Number three was the Association of Trial Lawyers of America, another familiar face on the political scene. Tort reform was their issue, that was their biggest issue this year. That did not go through when the president vetoed the bill. Again, Nancy will give you some more details on that. The bottom of the top 10 list, five of them were unions, Teamsters, Laborers, IBEW, National Education Association, and the American Federation of State, Municipal, and County Employees, State, County, and Municipal Employees, and two more companies, RJR Nabisco, another business group, and the American Medical Association, the doctors. Now I want to turn to PAC contributions, and if we could have the second set of charts. With the PAC contributions, we were able to actually take a compare apples to apples and look at how things had changed from the 19... from the 1994 election cycle to the 1996 cycle. And here we looked at just what had come in the first 18 months of the cycle, which is through the end of June. And what we found here is, this is breaking apart the sectors, fairly much what we found the last time. There were a few sectors that were up considerably. In fact, the one that grew the most by 39% was the communications and electronics sector. That was the biggest grower. Again, that was absolutely, directly, no question about it, tied to the Telecommunications Act. There was a lot of money flowing into Washington when that bill was being considered. Interestingly, the one that grew the least this time is the one that has grown the most in the last two election cycles, the health sector, which only grew 4%. So that's basically a rundown of the biggest changes in what we had. But as is often the case with these big sectors and big numbers, there are some more very interesting stories as you look a little bit closer to it. And really, this year, the big interesting story on the PAC money is how it switched from the Democrats to the Republicans once the Republicans took control of Congress. In fact, the more we looked at this, the more interesting it got. If you look at the top chart here, and depending on how close you are, you'll see it better or not so good. The light bar is, first of all, this is the PAC totals to Democrats on the top chart, and the bottom is the PAC totals to Republicans. The light bar being what they got in 94, the darker bar being what they got in 96. You'll see they look about the same, maybe a little bit of a drop for the Democrats in this view of it. For the Republicans, you see a lot heavier and larger dark bars than you do light bars. That's because they got a lot more money. Again, the more we looked at this, the more we found this story is very interesting, And in fact, when we broke it down by industry and sector, these big sector groups and the more detailed industry groups, and then looked at the difference between the sectors, it was even more stark.
And you're listening to Larry Mackinson with the Center for Responsive Politics. The center issued its big report yesterday on campaign contributions in the 1996 election cycle. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. Listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman. As we've been reporting over the last week, Indonesia has been making headlines ever since two East Timorese independence and human rights activists were named winners of this year's Nobel Peace Prize. In the past week, the Los Angeles Times, Washington Post, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and other newspapers around the country have revealed in dozens of articles that the Clinton campaign has accepted hundreds of thousands of dollars from a billionaire Indonesian family named the Riyadis, tied to the brutal Suharto dictatorship and tied to the Democratic National Committee through one of its fundraisers named John Huang. Now GOP presidential hopeful Bob Dole has been raising the issue on the campaign stump, and House Speaker Newt Gingrich is calling for hearings on whether the Indonesian money has affected U.S. foreign policy and trade policy toward Indonesia. These events have broken decades of official silence on Indonesia and its occupation of East Timor. The U.S. has virtually ignored Indonesia's appalling human rights record while criticizing its neighbors like Burma for similar abuses. The big news yesterday was that Newt Gingrich held a news conference spending almost the whole hour talking about Indonesia, and he called for the U.S. to cancel the planned sale of F-16 fighter jets to Indonesia. He was responding to questions by journalist Alan Nairn.
There's no question in my mind that we should postpone any action towards Indonesia until we've had a chance to review this. I mean, this scandal is only a week old. So I think what we've got to do is say that everything this administration has said about China and Indonesia is now suspect, pending our review of whether or not we were getting what the State Department actually thought, or we were getting what the Riyadis and John Huang thought the administration should say. And I don't think we know today. I'm just saying, I think you've got to have a very serious question about what was it that Clinton was doing that was so valuable that they would funnel $450,000. You know, this one couple is the eighth largest contributor to the Democratic National Committee. They're larger than the American Trial Lawyers Association. Now, why was it? I mean, I don't personally believe it was the two letters. I mean, maybe it was, and maybe those letters were just fabulous, but I find that a little implausible. So that's why I'd come back and say, we ought to find out what they thought they were getting for that kind of money. I think the Clinton administration should suspend any activities with regard to Indonesia until there's time for hearings and inside oversight.
And that was Newt Gingrich at a news conference yesterday responding to Alan Nairn's question. Alan Nairn joins us now. He's a freelance journalist who's written on East Timor and Indonesia for the New York Times and the Progressive and the New Yorker magazine, as well as The Nation. We did a documentary together based on our three trips to Indonesia and East Timor called Massacre, the Story of East Timor. Alan, can you please explain what's happened in the last week? There hasn't been coverage of Indonesia and East Timor, anything like this, for more than two decades. Who are the Riyadis? Who is John Huang, and what does this all have to do with the elections?
Well, the issue has finally broken through into the U.S. corporate press and is now on the public agenda for the first time. The Riyadis are part of the ruling circle of General Suharto in Indonesia. Suharto has ruled Indonesia for 30 years as dictator. He's had U.S. support all along in terms of weapons, military aid, military training, and multilateral financing, which finances a third of his government budget. But it seems that Suharto wanted to buy insurance on top of the bipartisan Washington support he had enjoyed over the years. It seemed he wanted to buy this, especially in the wake of the 1991 East Timor massacre, which we both survived. Since after that massacre, there was a surge of grassroots organizing in the United States to try to change the U.S. policy on Indonesia and Timor. And this resulted in some setbacks for Suharto in Washington. There was a cutoff of IMET military training aid for Indonesia. There were some weapon shipments to Indonesia that were blocked. Suharto and his business associates launched a counterattack. They poured contributions into the Clinton campaign in 1992. This campaign, they gave a Riotti associate, John Wang, who had worked for the Lippo Group, the Riotti company. He's raised $5 to $6 million for the Democratic National Committee. The Riottis have also funneled money to Republicans. They have also worked with U.S. corporations like Texaco, Freeport MacMoran, Morgan Stanley, in funding various lobbying activities such as the U.S.-Indonesia Society, which is a front group that brings congressional delegations over to Indonesia, bipartisan congressional delegations. And this organization, which is funded by the Riottis, also is associated with Indonesian military intelligence, gets money from large U.S. corporations, has on its board many former Pentagon, CIA, and State Department officials, also has on one of its boards the son-in-law of General Suharto, a man named Prabowo. Prabowo made his name by staging especially brutal massacres in East Timor, he is now one of those working with the Riottis, working with the U.S. oil companies, and Freeport MacMoran and the others to try to lobby the U.S. Congress. So this thrust with Clinton and the Democrats is part of a larger effort on behalf of the Suharto regime, but ironically, it's almost icing on the cake since they've enjoyed bipartisan support from Washington all along.
You know, it's interesting that people like Senator John McCain, who is one of Bob Dole's biggest advocates, as well as Newt Gingrich, they're calling for an independent counsel to investigate the Indonesian money, what everyone is calling the Indonesian connection. Newt Gingrich holding a long news conference yesterday, over an hour, simply talking about Indonesia, when in fact these Republicans, as well as Bob Dole, has been supported by the Indonesians as well, and they've, as you said, there's been bipartisan support for the brutal dictatorship. Why is Newt Gingrich risking this and risking the exposure of Republicans and their connections to Indonesia and their support of the regime?
Well, they're desperate in the elections. This is about all they have. It looks like Dole may lose, and Gingrich is in danger of losing his speakership. So, and this is a genuine scandal involving Clinton and the Democrats. These are clearly corrupt contributions, at least morally, if not legally. So he'll take the chance. But it certainly has been bipartisan support for Suharto. Dole himself, in July of 1994, while he was the Senate Minority Leader, helped kill an amendment offered by Senators Leahy and Feingold, which would have prohibited the use of U.S. weapons in East Timor in accord with the existing treaty, military treaty between the U.S. and Indonesia. Gingrich himself, through the House leadership this past spring, helped to restore some of the military training aid for Indonesia that was cut off after the Timor massacre.
Alan, we only have about 30 seconds. Do you think overall, what do you think of the corporate media's coverage of what's going on right now? Do you think they're framing it in the right way?
Well, they're missing the point. The real question is, why is the U.S. supporting the Suharto dictatorship? Should it now continue to support the illegal occupation of Timor and continue propping up Suharto in the face of a growing democracy? democracy movement. I think the American public's answer to that, as they learn about this, will clearly be no. The fact that Gingrich called for suspension of the F-16 deal and the IMET military training until hearings are completed, that's a real step forward on the issue. This is strictly bipartisan. And I think people have to now go to the government and say no more support for this terror.
Well, I want to thank you very much, freelance journalist Alan Nairn, who's covered East Timor and Indonesia for many years. And I have to say, at that news conference yesterday, I did ask Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich if he would invite the Nobel Peace Prize winners José Ramos Horta and Bishop Bello to those hearings, and he said yes, absolutely yes. I had asked Mike McCurry, White House press briefing last week, the White House press spokesperson, if he would invite the Nobel Peace Prize winners to the White House, if President Clinton would, as they do with all other Nobel Peace Prize winners. He wasn't so sure. You're listening to Democracy Now!
Latino, Latino, echemos siempre para adelante, abrázate a tu destino. Latino, 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 echemos siempre para adelante, abrázate a tu destino. Latino, Latino,
haz bien a la humanidad, hazle bien a tu vecino. Yo te aseguro,
'60s and '70s, young Puerto Ricans organized for the empowerment of their communities across the United States. Among the organizations that emerged were the Movement Pro Independence, El Comité, the Puerto Rican Student Union, and the Young Lords.
On the whole, we were first-generation Puerto Ricans born and or raised in this country. And we found as we started going out into the world that the society was a very white society.
And the conditions in the community at that time were dire. There were a lot of drugs. The housing was abominable. The health care was non-existent.
It was a struggle as I was growing up in the city, and I saw a lot in the communities, and I saw the system in this community not helping any of the people that I relate to every day. I joined the Young Lords out of anger.
We all had a tremendous sense that our people did not deserve the kind of situation and the kind of condition that we were living under, that our parents had worked just as hard as anyone else to make a better life for us, and for some reason, we weren't succeeding. And so we had that commitment that we were going to change things, and it didn't matter what had to be done, but that we were going to change things.
Tonight and coming week on many public television stations, a new documentary will debut that looks back at the Puerto Rican civil rights movement led by the Young Lords in the 1960s and 70s. The Young Lords were a militant Latina group that grew up in the barrios of Chicago, New York City, Philadelphia, and other major cities. Like the Black Panthers, the Lords galvanized a generation of activists to provide much-needed services to communities long ignored by politicians. Right now, we're joined by Aris Morales, a co-attorney and director of the education at the Puerto Rican Legal Defense and Education Fund, and maker of a new film called Palante Siempre Palante, The Young Lords, and I'm sure I pronounced that wrong. Let me try again. Palante Siempre Palante, The Young Lords. We're also joined by Juan Ramos. He's founder of the Philadelphia Young Lords and currently the vice chair of that city's Police Advisory Commission. He's in Chicago right now to receive the Cesar Chavez Community Service Award from the U.S. Hispanic Leadership Conference. And yes, that last voice you heard on the documentary is Juan Gonzalez, co-host of Democracy Now!, and he was the former Minister of Education of the Young Lords. Welcome, Juan.
Thank you, Amy, and I want to welcome the other guests, my compañero and compañera from many years back, Iris and Juan. Are you both there?
Good morning, Juan. Good morning,
Good morning
Amy.
Good
morning,
Iris.
Morning.
I'd like to first start with Iris. This film has been, what is it, about 6-7 years in the making now?
Actually, it's been eight.
Eight
it was
years.
From that meeting that we had in 1988, as you may recall, where we talked about trying to do something to reach out to the next generation of young people, young Latinos that we were seeing had such a sense of hopelessness and were really looking for their place what was our history. And so we talked about doing a number of things, and one of the things was the video, and I signed on to do that, and it's 8 years later, and it's finally done.
Now, Iris, one of the unusual things I know, because I followed, obviously, your work on it for all these years, is that you took the tack of taking the work in progress to various universities and student groups and high school students. Why did you do that, and what did you get out of that process of making a film in that way?
Well, first of all, that idea came out of a screening that we had at El Puente. And it was the first time that the work in progress was seen. I thought we were going to present it to a small group of people, and in fact about 300 people showed up that evening, a lot of young people. And the young people themselves came to me, and I was actually, frankly, getting a little tired with the fundraising process. And they gave me new energy, and they said, let's take it out there, and we really need it, we really want it, this has to be finished. And I did that. So one aspect of it was the fundraising. The other was that in the course of doing that, people were being organized, and people were giving me feedback in terms of what the needs and the issues are that are facing the community today. And I think that in the end, the documentary is really stronger for that. So it's been a whole organizing process. So any of the screenings that we've had, we've had 300 people, just word of mouth, and young people.
Yeah, Juan Ramos, you were the defense captain in Philadelphia, and I remember back in the early 70s going out there quite often, and you were under then a lot of attack, that chapter there. I think your office was firebombed about two or three times, as I recall. And now you're one of the best-known Latino leaders in the city. You're a vice chair of the Civilian Complaint Review Board there, appointed by Mayor Ed Rendell. What kind of impact do you think a film like this is going to have on the Puerto Rican Latino youth or general youth in the city of Philadelphia?
I think it should have a very big impact. Just last year, PBS did a special documentary on youth activism, and it was interesting because at least half of it related back to the movement of the Young Lords a couple decades ago. So I think I think young people are hungry to know about their history and their culture, and those of us that preceded them. I think that there's a lot of young folks that want to know and want to get involved, and I think this showing should be stimulant, for our young people to know that although you might not be able to do it the way that we did, but that there is a need and a very pressing need in our times for young people to step forward so that people like Iris, you, and I, Juan, can follow them.
Absolutely.
We're joined now by Minnie Soya, who was also a member of the Young Lords back then and is now an organizer with 1199, the Hospital Workers Union. And Minnie, we have by phone Juan Ramos from Philadelphia and Iris Morales in New York City. And we're talking about the film. You have come out in the film, or you will be, people will see you tonight. What changes did you go through even about participating in the film or getting those experiences out after so long?
First, I want to say good morning to everyone. And bringing those experiences back to me was a very exciting time when I was asked by Iris Morales to come and get interview so I could speak on my experiences on the Young Lords Party. My experiences with the Young Lords Party is what made me today what I'm doing now as an 1199 organizer with the 1199 National Health and Human Service Employees Union is the same, it's similar work of what I had done at the Young Lords Party, bringing unity in the community, breaking down barriers where people were able to come together so that we can deal with the issues of the community, housing, education, healthcare, Also, it was a really proud feeling for my children. I have teenagers. I'm a grandmother now, and they are very proud of what I'm about. So for me to be in the documentary, today is a very big event for me and my family, my coworkers, my friends, my union activists, that I'm proud to say that I was in the Young Lords Party.
In terms of, you know, a lot of people say, they call me up and say, oh, you were in the Young Lords, now you're a Daily News columnist, you sold out, you've forgotten, you know, what your principles were about. What has happened, Iris? You've been able to interview and chronicle what has happened to many of the Young Lords since then, and the film has a little of that. What's your sense of what happened to many of those Young Lords?
Well, what I say to people is that we reflected the Puerto Rican community then, and we continue to reflect the Puerto Rican community now. We all came in the main at that time from working class communities and from the range of experiences from having been in Vietnam to having to deal with drugs to starting to go to college. And that was the range of the Puerto Rican community then. And I think similarly today, we represent the range of the Puerto Rican community. There are people that have remained active, people like Richie Perez, who's been very active in police brutality work, especially and currently, and especially around raising the issue of Anthony Baez and the pattern of police abuse that is still occurring in our communities.
Iris, we're gonna come back to this discussion in a minute. We do have to break, and mentioning Anthony Baez, we should let people know around the country that there has been major marches since the verdict came down acquitting the police officer involved in his death. Just a few days ago, close to 1,000 people marched in the Bronx. Iris Morales is attorney and director of education at the Puerto Rican Legal Defense and Education Fund and maker of a new film on the Young Lords. We're also joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez, who is former Minister of Education in the Young Lords, Juan Ramos, founder of the Philadelphia Young Lords, and we're also in the studio with Minerva Sola, former Young Lord. We'll be going back to this discussion in just 60 seconds. You're listening to Democracy Now! Listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. And for those stations just joining us who are in fundraising, we are talking about a new documentary that's debuting around the country on public TV stations that looks back at the Puerto Rican civil rights movement led by the Young Lords in the 1960s and 70s. Young Lords, a militant Latino group that rose up out of the barrios of Chicago, New York City, Philadelphia, and other major cities. Our guests, Iris Morales, who is the maker of a new film on the Young Lords called Palante Siempre Palante. And we're also joined by Juan Ramos, founder of the Philadelphia Young Lords, currently the vice chair of that city's police advisory commission. Minerva Sola is on our New York studio at WBAI, former Young Lord and current union organizer for the Hospital Workers Union. And we're joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez. Yes, he too was with the Young Lords, former minister of education. Juan, let's go back to the time when you and a group of people formed the Young Lords. Tell us what happened. What was the stimulus at the time, and what year was it?
Well, this was in the summer of 1969, actually, and at that time, of course, the black liberation movement in this country was at its height with the formation a few years earlier of the Black Panther Party, and there was all kinds of activities and student struggles. The war in Vietnam was raging. That was the height of the Vietnam War, and Nixon had been elected president, and the beginning of the law and order frenzy that it continues to dominate this country, that was the beginning of it. And so a bunch of us gathered in the summer of 1969, originally in a group called the Sociedad de Luis Ocampos, after the Nationalist Party leader of Puerto Rico who had died only a few years earlier. And then we subsequently heard about a group in Chicago called the Young Lords, a street gang in Chicago led by Jose Chacha Jimenez, which was attempting to become or had developed into a revolutionary political group. And so some of us, Pablo Guzman, Mickey Melendez, myself, a few others, drove out to Chicago to meet Chacha and eventually got his go-ahead to form the New York chapter of the Young Lords, came back and started it that summer in 1969.
They were taking over buildings and churches?
Well, we started actually by sweeping streets on 111th Street between 1st and 2nd Avenue. We started every Sunday just sweeping the streets because when we went around to people and started talking what were the concerns that they had, the number one problem that people saw was the garbage in the streets that the sanitation department wasn't picking up. So we figured, okay, this is what the people want. This is what we'll do. So we started sweeping streets and then beginning to pressure the sanitation department to pick up the trash by blocking 3rd Avenue and 2nd Avenue and with the hundreds of trash bags. Because after a while, we got scores and scores of people involved in picking up the trash. And gradually, these protests expanded every week until they became known as the East Harlem Garbage Protests. And that was when the first New York Times article came out about the Young Lords in August of 1969. Subsequently, then, the group got involved in many other activities. Began organizing free breakfast programs, and maybe Minnie can talk a little bit about the health programs, because one of the areas that people have no idea about, the tremendous impacts on reforms in the healthcare delivery system in New York and other states that the Young Lords were able to accomplish. I don't know if Minnie probably remembers the lead poison detection program that we started with a bunch of medical students from Flower Fifth Medical College, which no longer is even there, the old New York Medical College. And these radical medical students came to us and they told us, hey, we think that there's a problem with lead poisoning and kids eating flaking paint. We don't have any proof for it. Would you Young Lords go with us door to door getting urine samples from kids in East Harlem? And sure enough, we did. Sure enough, they came with incredible numbers, percentages of positive findings. And then we were able to get Jack Newfield, who was then at the Village Voice, to do a big expose. The result was a Lindsay administration initiative and legislation passed to eliminate lead-based paint from New York City tenements. All that resulted from the work of the Young Lords. But Minnie also participated in some of the other health programs. Do you remember some of those, Minnie?
Yeah, I wanted to say that we joined together with healthcare workers at Lincoln Hospital and also at the Gouverneur Hospital. And they became an affiliation of the Young Lords Party. They were known as ATRIM, the Health Revolutionary Unity Movement. And we basically took over certain areas of the hospital to demand for adequate health care and closed down units, did take over overnight. And it was as a result of what the community was crying for at the time, like Juan mentioned. The concerns of the community was, we landed up sweeping the streets. We went into the healthcare issues. We did the lead poisoning. We also were the first ones, and I believe this was out in Connecticut, to bring an X-ray truck out to the community. That was a really big thing for us, because it was taking over trucks, it was taking over churches for the community in the churches. We had, like Juan said, our breakfast programs. We had the clothing program. We had
Minerva, I wanted to bring Juan Ramos into the discussion since he was doing sort of a parallel action in Philadelphia, founding the Philadelphia Young Lords. And I wanted to see if Juan could lay out the platform and whether you see that this platform could be applicable today.
Well, I think that the Young Lords, on account that we were a national organization, every other chapter outside of New York City wanted to copy what New York City was doing. So we basically followed the pattern that was very similar to the grassroots program that was outlined in our 12-step program. But I went through a very exhilarating experience about four years ago. I'm in the mayor's reception room in Philadelphia. He's getting ready to appoint the newly founded police review board that in Philadelphia we refer to as the Police Advisory Commission. And I was very surprised, one, that my name had been submitted and selected because of my history in the community around this one particular issue among many. But this particular issue I stayed very close to since the days of the Young Lords. And as he calls my name, all of a sudden I get this thought of community control of police. And I'm saying, isn't this something? This is the same thing that we were talking about in 1970. This was part of the Young Lords program. And after 20-some years, now we can say that there is a little bit of community control of what the police is going to do in Philadelphia. And those things that, like as Juan Gonzalez mentioned earlier, that around this time of year, 26 years ago, the Young Lord's office was set on fire. A pipe bomb blew up while a number of us were sleeping there one night. And I remember distinctly the night that the pipe bomb went off, that when we get out of the building, the first people that we see on the corner are two police officers in their cars laughing at us, right? And I always said, you know, I there was nothing. We were helpless at that point. And I said to myself, I wonder if these guys had anything to do with this firebombing. There was no way that we could ever find out. But I could say today that they will not do that ever again, stand outside of a building and laugh, you know, at a bunch of people trying to get out of a burning building. Nothing is because of the work and the program that the Young Lords presented to the community actually became an alternative program. This business of community control was so strong that now the conservative elements in this country and the Republicans, they all go around talking about revolutionaries. I don't know. I think Iris, Minnie, and Juan remember that. I mean, to be called a revolutionary was something unheard of, and now the most reactionary guy in the Congress of the United States considers himself a revolutionary. So I make a lot of parallels in my involvement in the community and with my family to those Young Lords days. We talked about culture, about keeping ourselves together. I'm at this conference in Chicago, and I thought it very important for my 11-year-old to take 2 days off of school. Of course, I got to clear with the principal and her teacher. For her to come here and see what Latinos, what Puerto Ricans were doing to better themselves in this country. So the Young Lords program was a very solid program.
Juan Ramos, one of the 12 points of that program, of the platform that you had in the Young Lords, was socialism.
We weren't just making a revolution in the external society. We were making a revolution in ourselves. You know, we had all read a pamphlet that was very famous at that time by Che Guevara called Man and Socialism, where he talked about how the fight to make a socialist, a new society, is also the fight to make a new individual.
But we suffered from all of the problems that exist in contemporary society between the sexes. The male chauvinism, the sexism, was amplified when you become a paramilitary organization. And the combination of factors made life rather miserable for the women in the organization for a period of time.
We managed to get women's caucus, and so every Sunday the women of the organization would meet. After meeting for several months, we decided to come up with a list of about 10 demands that we wanted to present to the Central Committee that at that point was all male.
And they were not requests, they were demands. One of the demands was that the program and platform of the Lords be changed, because there was one line in the program that said that machismo must be revolutionary, and we didn't see how machismo as a concept could ever be revolutionary. It's reactionary.
And you're listening to just a small excerpt from the new Young Lords film called Pa'lante, Siempre Pa'lante, and that's going to be airing throughout the country starting tonight. Iris Morales, what about this issue of machismo and feminism in the Young Lords?
The feminist issue was a very important one, and it was actually one that the Young Lords became known for after we had our internal struggles. The women felt that it was actually quite ridiculous to say that machismo must be revolutionary. That's like saying racism must be revolutionary. Of course, we were also influenced by the feminist movement at the time, and we were talking about a time when women's rights, I mean, was just coming into its fullness. But to the credit of the organization, we found ways to institutionalize the women's issue so that we would have child care, so that the program was changed, so that there would be women in leadership. So when women were put in the forefront as public speakers, and all of that had a tremendous impact on the Puerto Rican movement as a whole.
Juan Gonzalez, how were you feeling at the time? What kind of impact did this have on you since you were part of the Central Committee?
Well, it had a lot of impact on all the men in the organization. Obviously, because the first demand, obviously, was that women be named to the Central Committee. In addition, well the platform was changed. Then the first two women were named to the Central Committee at the insistence of the caucus. And then subsequently, also, many of the men, including myself in the organization, were disciplined at one time or another for male chauvinism. If we mistreated a partner or if we tried to mess around with somebody else in the organization, there was suspensions, demotions of varying durations for anybody who was found guilty of male chauvinism. And I don't want to get into who got disciplined the most, but I'd say that it was pretty prevalent throughout the organization.
Didn't the Young Lords also embrace the gay struggle?
Yes, very early in the organization, there was a gay caucus within the organization. I think we're probably the first Latino organization that I know of that ever had a gay caucus, and there were many gay members in the organization, and we saw the need to raise the issue of oppression against gays within the Latino community and the general society.
What about weapons? I mean, you talked about the Young Lords sort of being parallel to the Black Panthers. Where did weapons fit in?
Well, all the members of the Young Lords, we had a point in the platform that said that we believed in the right to armed self-defense. And all the members of the Young Lords, as part of their regular training while they were becoming what was called cadres in training, had to take both martial arts training and some degree of training in weapons, knowledge of weapons. And there were a couple of occasions where we were involved in protests where weapons were actually publicly shown, but we basically saw the need to organize the community around issues that folks were most concerned about, while recognizing the right that we had to defend ourselves if attacked. And I think part of what some people have asked, for instance, what was the kind of repression that the Young Lords faced versus, let's say, the Black Panthers or other organizations? We had quite a bit of repression, but never quite as extensive as it was in the Black Panther Party. I think largely because the society never considered Puerto Ricans as central a threat to the existence of the establishment as it did with the Black Panther Party and the Black community.
Well, I wish we could talk more about this, but people should call their local PBS stations and find out when the documentary is being run. It's called Pa'lante, Siempre Pa'lante, The Young Lords. And we have just about run out of time. I want to thank Juan Gonzalez, Juan Ramos, Iris Morales, and Minerva Sola, all former Young Lords. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin and engineered by Julie as well. Errol Maitland has been engineering in New York. We thank you for listening to another edition of Pacific Radio's Democracy Now!